I'll just start things off. One marked difference between the two papers is that in Marcus's paper, the idea is to help the users protect against their own bad choices, whereas in Robert's paper, you're really protecting them against an adversary, the tracking, the double click. And in particular, that adversary is quite well-funded, in fact, extremely well-funded, and has been known to do things like you mentioned, use flash cookies and other things to track people even when they're trying to extremely hard not be tracked, but fail to do so. So what can be done, for example, to protect against an adversary that's intentionally trying to trigger the trade-off you're making? So you talk about how you want to preserve functionality even at the expense of privacy, so when there's a choice to make, you will decrease the privacy. So if this adversary is intentionally trying to trigger this to make the privacy go away, what can you do to protect that?
Well, that's a really good question. And I would say that you have to sort of concede when using this approach that you're not going to be able to achieve the level of privacy that you would be with other things. The idea is mainly to try and do better than we're currently doing and to actually encourage users to actually use these tools. And I mean, you said that I'm trying to protect against against adversaries hurting users. I would also argue that I'm trying to protect against users hurting themselves, and that, you know, they turn off these tools already and they get really frustrated. And so if someone is trying to specifically attack functional privacy, I think we have to sort of concede that, hey, you know, we're not going to be able to really defend against that as much as we would like, but at least in most cases they're going to have more privacy than they would otherwise.
Let me add one thing. So there's a very nice saying, I think it's Yogi Berra, I should attribute it to it, that in theory, there's no difference between theory and practice, but in practice there is. And so if you know what the attacker is doing, for example, many attackers use the on-submit as a cue for stealing a potential password. If you know that, then you could modify your behavior so that you as the writer of the code, or so that you do not follow those patterns. If you're not the largest company in the world, they probably won't bother to go after you. And so it depends, of course, what the adversary is. That's the first question. And the second is how much they care.
Shane Clark, UMass Amherst. So I have a password question. I really like the idea of looking at distributions and just trying to avoid things that are common as a matter of policy. It's a really appealing sort of straightforward idea that seems effective. But I'm a little curious about if there are other ways you could formulate the rules you talked about. So you identified like concatenation, leet, and misspellings. But if you were to do an empirical study of how passwords are crafted, could you have come up with a different set of rules that would allow you to characterize passwords in a different way? Or do you think those distributions you showed would look the same?
I appreciate the question. This is study we did is in the context of passwords that already exist, which of course are affected by what we're currently doing. If you were to say, let's open up the field, let's do things in a different way, you will have different distributions. I believe that passwords today are very hard to remember, and they are not very secure if you look at the estimated bit security at all. A better thing would be to take a small collection of dictionary words, for example, 3 dictionary words. You could know the frequency of each one in language. You could know the frequency of the tuple of words, and therefore you could assign a probability to it. And that frees yourself from the current password thinking and instead looks at storytelling. You relate to something that happened to you. You're going to get different distributions, very different. There are going to be very few numerals if you allow people to do something like this, especially if you reward people for doing this by saying that the strength is really high now that you have these components. So it's definitely a problem that changes as soon as we start changing things as well.
Actually, I have a related thing. I'm going to jump in there. So there are, of course, other ways to generate passwords than those. And you say that it will, depend on how users are being rewarded or discouraged from selecting them. But so there's the common folklore, maybe, method of generating passwords, which is use the first character of each word of a phrase or something like that. I thought that was more common, and in reading your paper, it doesn't seem to come up at all. So do you really not see passwords that look that like they were generated like that, just a sequence of letters, but that's not a word in any way, or?
So it's relatively uncommon.
Is it?
We group things into things that we understand according to our rules and things that we don't understand according to the rules. So something that is a truly a random string or something that is a passphrase like what you're describing, we don't necessarily know how to distinguish between them, but the collection of such things, it's rather small. Now, for the data sets we looked at, there are some sites that very much encourage people to do that, and it might be different there. But if people are left to their own devices, they will not want to do this. In fact, they will want to use the same password everywhere, and not a very good password at all. I have some horizontal password data where I have the password of about 7,000 users on all their sites, and it's a dramatic reading. You see how people reuse to a very large extent. People are just not willing to think very hard, and I don't blame them. I do the same to some extent, and I'm sure you guys do too. We reuse because we can't remember 120 passwords.
Great talks. Question, I guess, for Mark. So in showing those distributions, I'm guessing the effect of the password policy that the users were mandated to abide by probably had an effect, right? So if they had to have a number, then maybe they had more numbers, and maybe they didn't care about the length as much. On other sites, they had to have a password that was 16 characters long. So I guess that's one question, whether you address that in the paper and can see what kind of influence they have. And the second question, I'll just ask them so you can answer them together, is how much does it matter whether a password is guessable in today's online world? I don't run a huge site, so I just don't know. Do regular users who are not actually targeted, so not journalists, but like regular average Joe users, have their passwords sort of guessed on
a
long basis?
Question. So let me start by addressing your second question first, which is whether it matters how strong it is. And it does matter for the weakest, say 10%, because those are the ones that will be automatically attacked. But it has an indirect interest for the others. Say that the 50% weakest passwords, those, except for the 10% lowest, will not be guessed using automated guessing techniques. However, somebody who has a password in that group has expressed a very weak security hygiene, you could say, and therefore, which is correlated with other poor behavior and increased gullibility and increased willingness to install malware. So a somewhat weak password is an alert of a high-risk user. So it doesn't mean that the password is bad, but it means that any transaction that is associated with this user should be given extra scrutiny. And then turning it around and saying those that are incredibly high, if we can distinguish between those that are set by password manager and those that are set by users, and that's typically easy just looking at the typing typing behavior, if you time it. Then you could say, well, something that's incredibly complex and which is not from a password manager is probably not going to be remembered. And therefore, it's not good. We're doing work with linguists right now to determine a more fine-tuned approach of asserting the likely recall rates for different passwords, which is important to organizations like PayPal, because a forgotten password means potentially a lost customer. And as for your first question, I don't remember. Please read the paper.
I had a question for each of you. For Marcus, it seems to me that your definition says a password is weak if it's frequent. Is that correct? A password is weak if it is frequent, if it is likely based on the data set that you have.
Then we're saying it's not so good.
Yeah. Yes. So what puzzles me is that that's a relative definition to the, you know, in relation to the group. And what if everyone followed your advice and they came up with really complex passwords? But if everyone did that, then those passwords would be likely. I think that you should come up with an absolute definition. You know, a password is either difficult to guess or it's easy to guess based on the guessing criteria that you have. Rather than what other people in the group are doing.
I'd like to disagree with that, because if you could actually rate the likelihood of passwords and you were able to steer people in a direction that all passwords are equally likely, I think you end up winning.
Yeah, but if I understand you correctly, you're not saying that Justin Bieber is pretty is a weak password because everyone says Justin Bieber is pretty. Everyone uses that password. You're saying that's a weak password because it has only words, right?
No, that's not the reason it's poor. It's poor because it's used on the Justin Bieber site. If you use that password on PayPal, I think you have a pretty amazing password.
Okay, so anyway, my intuition would be to look at the whole space of passwords. I mean, you're going in the right direction, I think, but I think that you should define the likelihood over the likelihood of the over the entire space of possible passwords rather than the passwords that are in use.
Well, it's site specific. One site has a different demographic for their users than another, and also different motivation of the users to retain strength of their password. And each site, of course, cares about their own security. For example, PayPal would not necessarily care about the security of Facebook users should it not have been the case that Facebook users use the same password on PayPal, because that's a problem for some other site. And so if there is a site with a very different demographics, that is not necessarily important to the site that doesn't share those demographics.
Okay, well, we can take it
Let's
offline.
Talk
and I had a question for the other speaker. So you were claiming that you should use these root tags for cookies because they might be reused on the other site, and it seems to me that it lowers the security of your, you know, the privacy of your scheme significantly. What's the trade-off? I mean, it seems to me if you don't use those, people just have to log on one more time, and that's quite okay.
So I agree, and it really pained me to add the concept of the root store to the tool. Because yes, you're right, it is something that isn't pretty, and it does reduce the privacy of the user. Now, I will say that you're a little bit mistaken in that if you didn't have that, then it would break the service. Like, it would not allow them to log in at all because the way that Facebook does redirects in the login service. So the cookies would actually be tagged with Facebook and then it wouldn't work anymore. So you wouldn't actually be able to use the authentication service. Now, one thing is that this isn't necessarily the end-all be-all solution, or at least Milk's not. I mean, we're trying to push across this idea of functional privacy, and there are already tools. We mentioned one being ShareMeNot that we've tested that handles these social widgets, and it actually works with Milk, and so they're sort of complementary in that way. And I agree that, yes, there's this trade-off, and in order to get this to work, you have to make this kind of sacrifice, but ideologically, we feel that, you know, if we want it to be functional privacy, we gotta say, okay, we'll just let this happen, and then we'll actually make this thing work.
Thanks.
So. Eric Wistrow from University of Michigan. About the passwords, do you have to store passwords in plain text, like the passwords of your users in aggregate, to do this type of analysis?
No. These are not passwords of PayPal users and of other users who are currently using the system. These are passwords that have been compromised, and
okay, so you have a blacklist.
The associated accounts have been blocked now. So there is no risk associated with me having them in plain text. And in fact, I'm very happy to share most of these passwords if anybody should be interested.
I had a question about milk. So we talked about the design compromise associated with using a root tag for certain cookies. Is there a currently hard-coded subset of domains that have the root tag applied to the cookies, or is that something that the user specifies?
Neither, actually. It detects when a user's on a login page and they successfully log in, then it adds the cookies to the root store.
So it's depending on the authentication feature of a particular domain then to apply the root tag.
Can you say that again?
Oh, sure. So I'm questioning where in milk the actual determination for a root tag to be applied to a cookie rather than just a regular.
So say you go to facebook.com, you sign in, hit sign in, then it would apply there, like on that page.
Okay, thanks.
More questions? Okay, well, people think of more questions and come down. I'll throw another one out. So, Marcus, you, in response to a question a few minutes ago, you said that, for example, PayPal doesn't care about the hygiene of the user's Facebook password, except that they might use the same password. I want to...
That's probably a statement I should have cleared with PR first.
Okay.
Please forget that I said that.
Well, I want to take a step back from that and kind of a more philosophical view. Does the company who runs website X, to what extent do they care about the passwords of their users? Like what, taking into account the externalities and all of those things, how much does it directly harm company X when one of their users gets their password compromised?
It depends on what, of course, the company is. And so PayPal doesn't like for PayPal users to have their passwords known by others than the actual user for obvious reasons. We also don't like passwords of email service providers to be known, because your PayPal username is the email address that you registered, and many people, a dramatic number of people, reuse across domains. So other organizations maybe have less interest in the email service provider emails than PayPal does, and it depends clearly on the situation in which you are and what you stand to lose. Email service provider in particular, in my view, have not so much concerns at all, because there's no great financial loss associated with the theft of a password.
Is there a danger that the company is worried about actual lost users or something? Would a user blame the site if their password is compromised and so stop using the service?
I think it depends on the service.
Yeah.
So if you lose money, of course, you get very upset. And if you are impersonated and your friends lose money, which often happens when people lose their Facebook passwords and they're used by attackers to impersonate them, saying that they're robbed in London and so on.
That's right.
Well, that's that sucks. There are various degrees of misery. Maybe on a site like New York Times, if you were to lose your password, you wouldn't care the least. And so I guess my answer is just depends, really.
Right. Fair enough. Okay. Over to there.
Serge Eigelman, UC Berkeley. Another question for Marcus, not to jump on. But I find it kind of ironic that you present this data and then say that, well, users, you know, I guess should be sort of nudged to maybe pick more complex passwords. But the data that you have, we have their passwords not as a result of any action of the users, but because of poor practices on behalf of the system administrators, say storing the passwords in plain text, or maybe not even, you know, not salting them properly if they do encrypt them. So I was wondering if you had some sort of, I don't know, idea of how much culpability really lies in the people who are implementing the systems as opposed to the users, because most of the data that I've come across has been released as a result of no action that the user has done.
See them as two different aspects. We use data that was often no fault of the user, and that we got a hold of it. But that is just for training, so that we could understand it. And then we make statements about how the world works and how passwords that we don't get our hands on would be formed and the likelihood of those distributions. So I see what your question is, but in my view, it doesn't matter.
I think it's, in terms of intelligently allocating resources. So we're using this data to then make arguments about users choose really weak passwords, but the weak passwords aren't the reason why we have those passwords. The reason why we know those passwords is because of weak system administration practices.
Right, but that's another, those are orthogonal issues, right? We know that many of these passwords came to be listed.
No, I don't think there are orthogonal issues, because I guess what I'm trying to say is that I would bet money that many more user accounts are broken into not because of the user chose a weak password. And I'm pretty sure that most of the data that we have from various breaches probably supports that.
You mean that it's breaches as opposed to user involvement? I would tend to disagree.
Do you have data?
Not that I can quote offhand, but I know the general numbers of corrupted accounts. And of course, this is site-specific again. But on sites that are very anal about their security, you won't find any corruptions of data, but you will find people being phished or having malware on their machines. And so from my worldview, there is a much greater number of user-involved compromises. But then again, of course, that might not matter when we care to judge the quality of a password.
Okay, thanks.
Hi, Juan Lang at Google. Marcus, I had another question for you about passwords. With respect to how much they form part of the problem, I'm curious whether viewing passwords as sort of a binary decision, right? When the user presents their credentials, then that's the only option, that's the only choice to make a risk assessment. I wonder if that's maybe not the right way to go about it.
That's certainly not how most organizations do. I know many large organizations assume that every password has been stolen. And they, of course, won't let somebody into an account who presents the wrong password. But having the right password doesn't mean that you're the person. They will also look at things like device ID and what the transaction is and things like that in order to judge the quality of the transaction.
Right. So that was sort of leading to the next part of my question, which was to what extent might you say, well, a weak password is relatively acceptable, given that we might have the opportunity to absorb a certain amount of the fraud that could take place.
Right. I would again reiterate that the supremely weak password, the 10th percentile weakest password, those should be avoided. Those are the ones that are single words there, or they're password one or something like that too, which of course complies with most password strength checker rules. Now, to the extent that it matters, you could tell the security hygiene, as I mentioned, of the user, and then indicate how likely it is that they would do things that you don't want them to do based on the password, as one data point. There are other indications too. Mm-hmm. And then you would use that in combination with things like, are they using an operating system they've never used before,
right.
a country that we don't know them to have been to, mm-hmm. and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Any other questions? All right, maybe we'll just close by saying, of course I use my cat's name as a password. My cat's name is YD3C plus capital Q, and I change it every 6 to 8 weeks.
Good for you.
Okay, I'd like to thank our speakers again, and thank you for coming to HotSec.